Good evening. Welcome to this evening's lecture by Ian Simpson, entitled Tower on the Thames. My name's Kate Goodwin, and I'm a curator of the architecture program at the Royal Academy. It's a bit of a mouthful. This evening marks the last in a series that the Royal Academy Architecture Program has been holding with the Cities program here, entitled Height Spread Impact. It's been over two semesters, the end of 2005 and the start of this year. We've had six lectures this evening's is the sixth lecture. So the series has looked at a selection of projects of various definitions of scale. We chose them because we felt they had potential now and in the future to really change and influence London's physical and social fabric. This idea, for me, was most clearly driven home by a lecture that was held about 3 weeks ago on the Stratford Master Plan. It was given by West 8, Arup & Associates and Fletcher Priest. And they showed a map which was completely reconfigured. They'd done some quite nifty stuff in Photoshop, but it repositioned how Stratford was seen in relationship to London and in relationship to continental Europe, this being driven by the time scale between them with the opening of the international tunnel link. And it, for me, really made me realise how things are, changes in infrastructure and master plans can shift how you view, one, your city, what is the centre. It made me question what is the centre of the city, centre of London, and also how an area like Stratford could reposition itself in relationship to not just the city it belonged to, but also a broader geographical context. As I said, these lectures have all been done in pairs. The other one on the idea of spread was given by Allies and Morrison and Perfurius on King's Cross. The idea of impact was explored by Sir Richard McCormick, whose practice, McCormick, Dumson, Pritchard, is looking at the Victoria Embankment, which is bringing to life an area of London which has been largely a little bit neglected or potentially underused for such a critical central core part of the city addressing the Thames. The other idea of impact was explored by Gustafson Porter with the Diana Princess of Wales Memorial Fountain. This looked at how a small gesture could have a large impact, but also on the flip side of that, how you tried to capture such large sentiments of a nation in a small gesture or in a moment in a memorial. The idea of height was first explored by Lee Polisano. He noted that London was not a vertical city, but he felt this did not mean that tall could not be integrated. He was discussing two towers, part of a cluster in the city. They were commercial towers. He discussed the idea of composing a skyline. He also discussed the tension between old and new that placing these new buildings in an older physical fabric had. He also discussed, which was, I guess, again, addressing the composition of a skyline, but the conversation between the two buildings that his practice at KPF had designed. One was almost a supporting structure to a far more elegant and expressive building. But we asked Ian Simpson this evening because we felt that it would make an interesting counterpart to the buildings that have been that Lee discussed, commercial buildings in the City of London, and specifically asked him to talk about One Blackfriars Road. Ian Simpson Architects has done mixed-use towers across the UK, including the Beetham Tower, Holloway Circus in Birmingham and Urbis in Manchester. Ian Simpson is the co-founder and director of Ian Simpson Architects, a practice which was established in 1987 and has offices in both London and Manchester, about 70 staff spread between the two places. Following the IRA bombings in 1996, Ian Simpson won a competition to master plan Manchester City Centre and has been closely involved with regeneration initiatives in cities across the UK. Ian has sat for 2 years on CABE's design review panel and has been a key thinker in architecture. This evening's format will be, Ian will discuss for about, give us a lecture for about 45 minutes. And then I'm going to invite two panellists up onto the stage to make comments and to start the questions, and hopefully to give us about half an hour, 40 minutes for some discussion and questions from the audience. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Ian to the stage.
Double boom. Is that a double boom? Is that okay?
Is anybody else having difficulty? There's some things in front of you if you're having difficulty over there. If you'd like to sit down here,
thank you. Sorry. Thank you for the opportunity to present my thoughts and the thoughts of the praxis today. I don't know whether that's. Can you hear that? Yeah. Yeah. At the back. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What I want to talk about today is obviously this evening is. One Blackfriars Road, which is a scheme that we submitted for detailed planning permission last June, and are in process of evolving the scheme, developing the scheme in response to comments and design changes that as a client, the client has required of us. The process that we've been through so far has involved quite significant consultation with CABE twice and Southwark and the GLA. And actually, there's been a very strong welcome towards the actual tower element to this scheme from all parties. There has been criticism about the lower level buildings, the extent of the social housing that surround the scheme and the extent of the public realm, which we are addressing as part of the redevelopment and the design of the scheme. But interestingly, the tower itself has been warmly received, although I'm not sure that's going to be the case tonight. I'm quite happy to defend the tower, and I'm going to primarily talk about the tower as a building in itself. Before I do that, I'd like to just touch on the site that we're dealing with, which is very much, as we interpreted it, a gateway to Southwark. It's a site that has been redundant for some time. In fact, mosquitoes are currently inhabiting the space in puddles of water. It's been unkempt and left. And it's actually a very, very important piece in Southwark's regeneration agenda. The site itself, well, there's nothing left of historic quality around the site from these maps that we see here. Clearly, it has, although quite interestingly, there's a tall building in the background of that image that you can see that I'm sure would have quite difficult issues now in terms of its context. However, the actual site itself has been carved up, particularly post-war, with this infrastructure, which was part of an ambition to create a roundabout here. Fortunately, that never happened. Originally, it was really just a series of wharfs and warehouses along upper ground. That was a key road, which obviously is quite limited in terms of its use now. It's primarily Blackfriars Road, which we all understand. In terms of the city, here is the site. It is located on the only north-south bridge in London. It's actually, if you draw a radius from that site, it is very much at the heart of London itself. The local context We've obviously got the King's Reach Tower here, Millennium Bridge, Blackfriars Road, Blackfriars Bridge. This is the site again in red here. The conservation areas to the left, it's not actually in a conservation area, and to the right here, Tate Modern. It's one block back from the river edge, and we think that the river edge is not a place to locate on a tall building here, but we feel very strongly that this location, one block back, can sustain a tall building. There's a lot of new build going on around Southwark. There's a palestra scheme by Allsops, Herzog de Meuron's, Tate, Maker reconfiguring this IPC tower here, and Allies and Morrison working on Bankside 1, 2 and 3 here. So it's a place that's very much about regeneration in my mind, and we've spent a lot of our lives really in sort of trying to change the perception of places. And we think this site is key in terms of what it can actually do for Southwark. Interestingly enough, it's also part of a riverside pedestrian walkway that does actually extend on and up to the Design Museum and so forth. But here, located primarily around the Tate, we've got the London Eye further down here. And this is a real sort of amenity. It's a riverside walk that we would very much like to plug into with the building in terms of its facilities and in terms of its public realm. In terms of connectivity, it's a very well-located site. It has London Bridge here, anchored by Piano's Shard building at the bridgehead to London Bridge. It has Waterloo Station here. It has Blackfriars and Southwark Tube. It has Thameslink proposal at this point here. So in terms of connectivity, it's very strong. We obviously worked with others like Space Syntax to explore the reality of how we might make those physical connections, not only tie into the riverside walkway, but tie into the city itself, to the north, and obviously served from this fantastic infrastructure that surrounds it. Here we have the sort of the icons along the river, the bridge, National Theatre. This has to play its part, not in as an overt tourist attraction like that, but certainly as a building that helps define the place. We strongly believe it's the right location for a tall building, but also a visitor attraction in itself, and to that extent we've created a rooftop viewing gallery that is publicly accessible. If we just step back a little bit from the site where we are now, originally it was occupied, well, relatively recently it was occupied by the Sainsbury's headquarter building, which is now demolished. This group of rectilinear blocks here, not unlike any other group of 60s buildings that surround the site. But that did set a precedent in terms of the rights of light, and what we had to do was develop a scheme that did not compromise those rights of light that were established under that existing building. If we actually look at the site, I've touched on the rights of light. This is the orientation, obviously north-south. It has a very busy road here, Blackfriars Road. It's surrounded by other buildings adjacent to it. This will be a development site. This will be developed within the next 10 years. There's no question about that. So it is overlooked. But it also has a proximity to the river. There's a small pub here, the Doggett's Pub, that allows a pedestrian route, physical route, and visual connection through to this part of the site here. Any building that sits at a height above this can actually have a visible relationship with the city beyond and the river as well. It is a brownfield site. It's not a piece of greenery. It's a derelict site. But importantly, it is a gateway to Southwark in the way that London Bridge is also a gateway marked by Piano's Shard. Now, it's also a site that is not compromised by any of the strategic viewing corridors. It isn't in the way of anything, basically, this site. And what I've tried to show with this, just as a marker for a tall building here, is the ambition that with the Piano building here, the Shard, London Bridge House, the notion that there's an opportunity of respecting the vertical of Tate Modern and starting to develop a marker for the gateway here, but also one that ties in with other existing tall buildings, such as the King's Reach Tower here and the LWT building here. This image, obviously, very, very highly connected pedestrian-wise and vehicular-wise. It's a site that has long views north and south along Blackfriars Road. It's, I've touched on the notion of the bridgehead, the marker here. This is the extended IPC tower, which has currently got planning permission. The gateway aspect, but also just in the context of other clusters of buildings. This building has to stand on its own because there's no guarantee that other buildings are going to come forward, but it's highly likely that other buildings associated with the proximity, there's a site behind here that has had proposals for tall buildings associated with it. As I say, there's the IPC tower. This is our building here. There's the Piano building here. And then importantly, at the heart of the borough is the Elephant and Castle, which to me is very much on a limb. This is a piece of regeneration that's fundamental to the success and future of that borough. And to simply say, okay, well, let's stick some buildings in the middle there and hope somebody will come without any sort of acknowledgement of marker, then I think that is a risk, which I think is significantly mitigated by placing buildings at that bridge, those bridgeheads, and leading to the heart of the borough at Elephant and Castle. Now, I've just indicated a couple of ambitions, but at the end of the day, what really drives us as architects, and it's totally different to what Lee might have been talking about in terms of trying to create a tower from a commercial floor plate, is that we really do want to create a beautiful building, a beautiful object. One that responds, obviously, to program, but also is very, very contextual. It's a form, and I'll come on to the form as we've evolved it, but it's one that very much allows the eye to move around it, not unlike Swiss Re, but it's a much gentler building than that. It's one that clearly addresses the city, the heart of the city, but gives that opportunity of creating a gateway. And what you've got to imagine is that the majority of the residential developments that we see around, and you can see it along the Riverwalk, there's Bellway and all sorts of other house builder developments that are along there, are the typical typologies of the red brick buildings with the floating zinc top. That is the typical residential model, and that is very much cost driven. What we're trying to do here is set a new benchmark for what a residential building and a hotel building could actually be in terms of an object. This scheme actually has planning permission on the site, so there's going to be a big building on this site. It doesn't matter what I do or what is rejected. This is a scheme that's designed by Foster's and currently has extant planning permission. And if we don't get planning permission for a building on that site, they'll build this. Now, I think everyone would recognise that this building itself I don't feel contributes particularly well. It's a to the site. It's a use that's sort of alien to the site. It's a commercial building. It's an office building. And we're trying to bring a public realm and activity onto this particular site. What that building and the original Sainsbury's building did generate was this diagram here, which, as boring as it may seem, is actually the rights of light diagram that we have to, it's an envelope that we have to work with. And the only way that one can actually extend beyond that is in this location here, where we can go vertically without materially affecting the rights of light. Obviously, one could just simply put a block on the site, a building that is a perimeter block, apart from the fact that you couldn't build that because it would compromise everyone's view from the adjacent buildings. It would compromise the rights of light. It's still in a massive building. It's a very oppressive. It could be anywhere, actually, that building. It could be in the middle of Milton Keynes instead of one block back from the river. It's dumb. It's not site-specific. And through our experience of working with this sort of model of residential and hotel use, we've actually developed a typology that is very much focused around a small footprint. Now, a commercial office building needs to have a viable footprint of maybe 20, 25,000 square foot. A residential building needs to be only about 8,000 square foot, and it can reduce. So, in broad terms, one is able to design a much more slender residential and hotel building than you can ever do with a commercial building. And if you actually look at the Shard, it's got a big, dumb office building at the base of it, and that's why it's 300 metres tall, because the rest of it is there to try and create this impression of a slender structure. So you've got 10 apartments, each of 10,000 square foot, a hotel and a ventilator on the top. I believe very strongly that mixed-use, high-density, high-rise buildings are a very sustainable way of redeveloping our cities. Now, you may say, as you know, many people in London do, London doesn't need redevelopment. Well, those people that say that are those people that don't need it. But if you look at a borough like Southwark, actually, you know, there's a lot of change needs to happen there. The perception of that place needs to change. When you look at a building that has got that sort of density and intensity of use on one footprint, actually, it's not eating away acres of green belt. It's actually about regenerating a brownfield site and maximising the potential of that site. And that allows us to create, to work with the infrastructure that I've talked about, reduces traffic. It's got one plug to it in terms of services and power and drains, so that all those infrastructure requirements are minimised. But it's also about starting to change the perception of the place. We wanted to create a form that was specific to its location, and to me that there's two generators there. One was the river, the scale of the river, the movement of the river, and the movement of Blackfriars Road. This wasn't a building that was trying to position itself in the middle of a piazza and call itself a circus. It's not an axial building in that context. It's about trying to develop a form that has a relationship with movement. Now, again, to me, pure forms and pure geometries are very, very suggestive of a very static building. And we've tried to evolve a much more organic and fluid form, one that is much more dynamic in its expression. We've tried to develop a form that's elegant and graceful, one that actually has a sense of movement, something that is about soaring, actually has some skyward momentum. And I think tall buildings need to have that. It's a very unique and distinctive profile. There isn't another one of these in the world. Okay, somebody's probably quite pleased about that. But this is very, very specific in terms of its shape and its proportions. It is expressly specific, and it's non-rational, and it's been very much developed through looking at the form as an object in the context of other buildings like this that sit around it. I've just indicated those two things because I take reference and I'm very interested in inspiration from objects rather than, I'm not really interested in the work of other architects particularly. But things like this, and this is a glass sculpture by a glass Danish glass artist called Timo Sarpanava, 1952. And that was something that was very much in my mind, a form that had a sense of movement, it had direction to it. It was one that had a slenderness in one profile, but then also quite a distinctive profile to the side. So it was quite unusual in that context. And then there's the obvious Brancusi reference as a very delicate structure that touches the ground lightly. These are just a series of working studies, but this is probably one of the earliest diagrams that we turned into a model. And it was a building that was about movement. It was a building that had a base to it that swept up and then rose and then looked back towards the city in that sense. We wanted to produce a profile that could be read at a distance, and that would change and vary, but a surface to that profile that would be definable and changeable as we come up close to the building, and I'll touch on that shortly. But this actual base to the building was something that we ended up sanding. This was an object that we worked very closely with and evolved into then a physical building. And these, again, some of the computer images that we moved towards this as a solution. So it's a form that's very much derived from its site. Its program, in many ways, is almost irrelevant when you're dealing with residential, because there's only so much you can do with a 750 square foot residential unit, yeah? So there's not about expressing the individuality of those spaces in a building of that scale. It's about creating something where the legibility of the parts is actually subtly expressed. The form is the object that is reinforced at the expense of that individual, where the whole is truly greater than the sum of the parts. But it's also about making a place, and we have a real public realm that we're creating here at ground floor level, certainly in the latest iterations of the scheme. We wanted a building that actually was curved, had faceted surfaces that would reflect light, clouds, and obviously the sky, but with an envelope, a skin to the building that was quite ambiguous in terms of what was happening within the building in terms of its program. The building itself, again, these are some images. We see Piano's building sitting in the background here. The cluster of buildings that Lee probably was talking about here, the city, the extended IPC tower. We don't have on this image any other buildings that we're aware of. And again, in model terms, we've tried to develop something that has that sense of movement and beauty in its form. Now, in terms of an analysis of that proportion, it's actually a very difficult thing to do. What is slender? What is elegant? I mean, we all know what's beautiful when we see it. We can recognize it. But actually, when you're dealing with a building, it's actually something that's quite difficult to define, no matter how many drawings or computer images we use. And at the end of the day, it's about the individual saying, I think that is a beautiful form, and that's where we got to. I feel it is. And I'm happy to have a debate about that. But it's something that is perceived through the eye, no matter how much technology we actually have supporting it. Obviously, we have to make sure that we're not selling something to the planners that can't be delivered in building terms. And we've worked very closely with an enormous team of consultants to ensure that what we're showing here will be built. As soon as we get planning permission on the site, we will start on site. It won't be waiting around for 2 or 3 years whilst we get a tenant. We will be building this building. It's about deliverability. We work very closely with our facades to ensure that the envelope of the building, which is composed, the outer skin, is every single piece of glass is individual and unique to its location on the building. And even the prow of the building here has a very gentle radius to it that is actually 2 kilometres radius. Just to put it into the context of other city centre buildings, this is where we are here in terms of height. Obviously Lee's building here, which I think has come down a little bit now, and I think Renzo's is still the tallest building. Swiss Re, and so on. Some other images. And I've just produced a little image here just to show you what we are able to do in terms of the footprint of the building in the context of floor plates of other towers that we see around. This building fits comfortably inside of Swiss Re. It's actually half the width of Swiss Re Tower and slightly taller than that. Just as a reference point in terms of scale, because it's quite difficult to think actually how slender this building is, but Fat Boy Slim's thing springs to mind when I look at that. But it's not just about a tower, it is about other buildings, and in this iteration of the scheme, we're very much gathering the social accommodation around a public space with a hotel at the ground floor level. We've got a building that actually is divided as a hotel in section. Everything, the servicing and so forth, is all underground. It's not at surface level. There's a health club and restaurant at this level here, a winter garden, residential, and then a public viewing gallery at the very top of the building. Obviously, the building is sustainable. I mean, Ed, there's a lot said about sustainable architecture, and at the end of the day, to me, it's not a bolt-on thing. It's just a way of thinking. And we've always tried to design in a very low-energy, passive way. Now, obviously, we can bring in active systems such as photovoltaics, ground-based heat pumps. All those sorts of things are actually incorporated within this building. But at the end of the day, if you have a building that is well-lit naturally and naturally ventilated, then you're cutting down on the amount of electricity. And we've developed a twin-skin solution here that allows us to mitigate between the external envelope and the thermal requirements of the internal spaces. The external envelope is the element that actually deals exclusively with the form of the building. The internal skin actually deals with all those issues to do with heat loss, glare, and privacy. I'll come back onto materiality in a moment. This again is just a diagram to try and see it in the context of the approved reworking of this scheme here. which is very much about creating a diagonal across the site here. And we want to be able to move through this site. And on the later versions of the scheme, we're looking at being able to move externally across the site as well. Again, the section sitting in the context, low-level perimeter buildings, respecting the context of the rights of light. And again, worked up plans, working around a public space that is surrounded by restaurants and gallery spaces, public activity, and a very active ground floor, which again is something that is very important to us when designing tall buildings, and particularly when we're able to introduce a hotel. We can have, obviously, entrance areas, we can have restaurants, cafes, retail. It's a piece of the city. It's not an enclosed, gated community for rich residents. The residents actually have a very small entrance, and they just simply move through that public realm. It's about an active street frontage. This is an early image of the corner. Again, that's being reworked now, because the criticism was very much about the movement across the diagonal under here, which was adopted really and approved under the Foster scheme. But we've moved away from that now, and we're actually mitigating that that trafficking across that diagonal. It's much more narrow, and our building is now going to set back from that corner. Again, the base of the building with the activity, the life and variety, and the public realm on the roofs of the buildings, on the terraces relating to the affordable accommodation here, the garden spaces, and the public realm, which is approached from the front of the building through a natural incline into a public space here with a kiosk and a restaurant, which then gives you access to the very top of the building. Again, just some elevations in context. It's very difficult to communicate the quality of a building like this, because to actually communicate how light moves across the surface of a building is something that can only really be done by example, and it's only now that we actually have examples of those buildings, particularly in Birmingham and in Manchester. A whole series of every single floor plate is distinct and unique to its location, leading up to the top of the building, where we have this tremendous public space that gives you views, 360 views, degree views across the whole city. Again, these are just one of the models, group of models that we've produced to try and convey the quality of the building. I think if I just touch briefly on materiality, it's a very important component into the way that we think about architecture. Inevitably, at the early stages, it's a form-driven, a contextual program, form-driven exercise for us when you're dealing with this sort of program. Obviously, if you're designing a library or an opera house, then one has a much more interesting program to work with. But if you're designing 220 residential units and 375 hotel bedrooms, then there's a limit to what you can actually extract from that as a program. However, in terms of the material, the material choice in the organisation is in complete service to the form. It's not doing anything else other than trying to reinforce the form of the building and respond, in that sense, to context and function at a more subtle level. It's an architecture which we've evolved that... in which the actual structure is subsumed, with all respect to the structural engineers who have done a fantastic job. So it's not about the expression of structure. And other architects will totally disagree with that. And it's nothing to do with that sort of modernist code where every single articulation needs to be expressed. I'm not interested in that whatsoever in terms of structure, let alone in a building like this. The expression of the structure, you can look at any 60s council block where the floors run through to the edge. That's an expression of structure in terms of a tall building. We're not particularly interested in that. The structure is very much it's a skeleton or a network, effectively, with the expression of the floor minimised completely as in terms of its subservience to the form. The envelope is flush and smooth, and it's clearly non-load-bearing. The envelope would never be load-bearing in a situation like this. It's only ever going to be clipped onto the outside of the building. Having said that, with that as a driver, we're able to create what I believe is an architecture of lightness, one that's very much about the surface, in which you can actually start to treat the surface as a screen in many ways. It's a taut surface that's almost stretched tightly over the program and the structure that's driving and supporting the actual form itself. But the envelope is very much a two-dimensional element, but quite often wrapping a very, very complex three-dimensional form. The individual rooms themselves are only ever articulated at night when the light goes on, and then you just get the room articulated within the context of the building itself. And it's that sort of interplay, really, between the transparency, the opacity, the translucency, the surface, and the way that light works around that, whether it's over just the course of one particular day or over the seasons, that really excites me in terms of how a building like this can be brought to life. And we've actually explored, in this instance, opportunities of trying to create a totally reactive skin, that one that reacts totally to as the sun moves around it. It could not look like anything else other than a building on this particular site. Very, very orientation specific, in which you might start to get reactive glass becoming opaque and cutting out solar gain, and that is something that constantly moves. And then you have the individual within expressing themselves at a subtle level. The building itself is robust enough to accept that and welcome it, rather than going through the Mesian route of everybody having white blinds. The actual building itself is composed of the two layers indicated on this model here, a series of insulated and clear panels, movable panels. It then has an outer skin that has a series of radiating mullions to it that actually are about reinforcing the form. Totally in contrast to this, these are elements that sit on the floor and span between the soffit of the floor above. This is a surface that is curved. It's a curved surface, warped pieces of glass, because every single surface on this building has a slight curve to it, perversely. Some of them have very, very complex curves, but it's all completed as a single layer of glass, of white glass. Those two are then composed together to give us what we have currently described on our drawings and our models. Although the reality of the colour is something that we would obviously be exploring. But it's something that, in many of our other buildings, it's a theme that is recurrent. It's the coloration of that as the light moves around. This is Urbis in Manchester. Again, that's the same view of the same, another view of the same building at a different time of day. This is number one Deansgate. Again, an outer skin of glass. One that actually is at certain angles, picks up the sky, but also can also pick up life within. So you actually see the activity going on inside the building. And I think the building's robust enough to accept the choice of furniture, the way that people use those balcony spaces, because it's strong. In Birmingham, we've just completed a tower where we've been more overt in terms of the use of colour, more dogmatic in terms of pattern. Again, this is a hotel and residential building, and the coloration and the light, the way that light comes through into this space, is just quite amazing. And again, these are two images at different times of the day of the completed building. And a very early image of number one Deansgate. It doesn't actually have horizontals, it's just the protection. But this building changes completely as you move around it within the city and at different times of the year. Just quickly back to Blackfriars. Again, that richness, that texture, is something we want to explore within this building. The sense of direction is reinforced at every opportunity, where we have the inverted south-facing elevation to the building that has a whole array of photovoltaics on this slope here. But it's one that, to me, has very much a sense of direction. Again, the building in the context of Blackfriars Road, without the extended building here. Side elevation. Side elevation. I think the building itself, if we are able to move forward with something of this scale, is really important in terms of the perception of Southwark. We are in negotiation and about to sign up a hotel operator that's a 6-star hotel that is better than any hotel in central London, and in terms of the quality. It's going to create 450 jobs on this location. It's about training. It actually occupies 70% of the volume of the building. And they want to be in Southwark, of all places, because we're proposing this building in here. Not because Southwark is what it is, but because they want to be associated with this. Which, to me, is an exciting vindication of what is possible in terms of how the building can actually help the physical and perceptual regeneration of a borough like Southwark. Now, in other cities other than London, and we work a lot in other, particularly northern cities, Leeds, Manchester, Birmingham, Liverpool, they're obviously a totally different scale of city. Manchester will fit 7 times inside London's congestion zone in itself. So it's difficult to compare a global world city like London with anything else. But within the city itself, there are boroughs, there's Hackney, there's Southwark, there are deprived areas that are just as desperate for regeneration and perception change, I feel, as a city like Manchester. Now, when a city understands that it's about regeneration, there is a political agenda, and that change is embraced at a political level. And you see it in a city like Manchester, it's embraced. It's, you know, we're building the tallest residential building in Western Europe. It's 171 metres. It's 15 metres shorter than Swiss Re in the city of Manchester, and everybody loves it. They really do enjoy the fact that this building is being built in this city, and it's raised the ambitions of the individuals who live in that city. There's no question about it. Now, where we get political confusion and there isn't a strong direction, then there's the nimbyism, there's a tentativeness of, well, we've not had one before. Can we sustain one now? We're not sure. Maybe we should compromise. Yeah, we can still do something good, but as we know, good really is the enemy of excellent. There's no question about it. There's a lot of good things out there. but there's not that many really excellent buildings. I think we've got an opportunity here in Southwark to create something that is distinctive, that is unique. I'm not saying we're totally there yet with the building. There's lots of work to do. There's particularly lots of work to do on the lower levels, which we are working with Southwark and the GLA and CABE to evolve and develop that. And that can only get better for the building itself. And whatever happens on this site, a big building will be built. It's not like this is ever going to be a park. There will be a tall building on here. Now, the question is, what is tall? That is the issue. What is tall? This building is visible from St. James's Park, actually from a 1950s bridge that was built across St. James's Park, and it's visible not above Horse Guards Parade, not above any of the historic buildings, but it's actually visible to the left of the London Eye. Now, there's an anxiousness about that visibility. Other tall buildings in the city just about project, but in a minor way, because actually they're set, whilst they're taller buildings, they're set further back. There are other buildings in neighbouring boroughs that will be tall buildings that will impact on that view. However, it's something that we need to address. But the bottom line is, for it not to be visible within that sight line, we would need to reduce the building by 50 metres. And then English Heritage would probably be quite content with that because it's not visible. It's still a 160-metre building on that site. The danger is that we end up with a building that is not as elegant and beautiful as could have been achieved on that site when the scale of that building, for all intents and purposes, will be identical for those people that use the city and use the borough. However, that is an exercise that we're going through at the moment. As I say, there's a lot of work to do. And these are some of the early images. We even wanted to look at sort of having this dot matrix of refractive dots on the glass so that you actually get this very, very beautiful form in the evening. And it's, as I say, we're in process, and this is very ambitious, and inevitably when you do a tall building, wherever it is, and we don't just do tall buildings, we do spent a lot of years working in historic contexts and very sensitive buildings, so we are sensitive to that, but in certain situations like this, we think a building such as this is in the right place. What my job is to do is to try and make sure with the team that we have is that it's the most beautiful building that we can propose. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ian. I'd like to invite our two panellists for this evening up to the front here. We've got Robert Tavener, who is the director of the LSE Cities Program and Professor of Architecture and Urban Design. He's held professorships at Edinburgh University and Bath University and has written books, a monograph on Alberti as well as Palladio, and is co-editor of Body and Architecture on the Changing Relation of Body and Architecture. He's also a registered architect and runs a consultancy advising architects and developers on issues of architecture and urban design. We've also got Jeremy Melvin, who is a consultant to the architecture program at the Royal Academy of Arts, who's very much behind the direction and the formulation of the program at the Royal Academy. He's written a book on FRS York and quite recently on architectural isms. He's a critic, writer and lecturer. And I'd also just like to say that tonight's quite special with our panellists because both Bob and Jeremy have been very much behind the formulation of the series. It was Jeremy who suggested the idea of height spread impact at London. So over to our panellists who will each hopefully give us about 5 minutes or so of comments.
Thank you. Possibly less. I'd like to start off by saying that I'm a supporter of this building. I'm one of those many people, I think, who think that it would be an excellent addition to that particular location. I think it works particularly well through its height with the linearity of Blackfriars Road and Blackfriars Bridge, and in terms of being a gateway from the north into Southwark, would set up all the right signals about the regeneration of a borough which has gone through some very poor times architecturally in the last 50 years or so. However, I think there's an issue I want to pull out is the one of what is contextual, because I think it's very hard for many of us to understand that a tall building can be contextual. And I think, as Ian Simpson has pointed out, in many ways its form is a personal interpretation of an artist's artwork. It's something that he has chosen as a form and, in a sense, implanted or proposes to implant on that particular site. So it's not contextual in the sense that it's grown out of the traditional forms of that site. As he said, there aren't any real traditional forms that are left there. But clearly, in terms of the series of lectures that we've heard in this series, the two tall buildings are the least contextual, but they're contextual in different ways. And I think it's just worth dwelling on that for a moment. I mean, the King's Cross development, for example, is clearly contextual in that it picks up on a traditional street and place pattern that we're familiar with in European cities. It deals with building blocks of a scale that grow out of the scale of buildings that are around there. At another extreme, it might be argued that Lee Polizzano's Bishopsgate Tower is contextual because there is a very dense cluster of tall buildings in the eastern cluster in the City of London. But as Ian's pointed out on this site, there are tall buildings nearby, but it's not that sort of very visible cluster of tall buildings that is so characterised by the Eastern Cluster, and which English Heritage and Kane have recognised as being an appropriate place for tall buildings. And I think this is what causes the dilemma for English Heritage at the moment. They are concerned, as are many people who take their stance, if you like, in this debate, that it's wrong for an architect, no matter how talented perhaps that architect, to put forward, in a sense, an idiosyncratic design on a site because they think it's beautiful. So I think, I mean, one could go on about this. As I said, my view is that I think it could well be a very beautiful building, and I think that it would be appropriate for that site. But I think the issue of what is contextual is a matter of scale and degree. I wouldn't call this a contextual design. And I think in the end one has to ask the question, does every site have to have a contextual response to it? Perhaps by Ian Simpson, in a sense, framing it in a contextual way, it's leading to the confusion in English Heritage and in other people's minds about what is appropriate in certain locations. Cities are made of a mass of nondescript buildings, but occasionally it's right to have buildings that actually raise the stakes, which actually have a character of their own.
I think, really, following on from Bob, it's interesting to think of context and beauty as sort of evil twins. You know, they're not quite opposites, but they would seem to be working against each other. That if something is beautiful, you are licensed to ignore context, and if something isn't beautiful, whatever that may mean and however it may be interpreted, you have to be contextual. Now, there was something, Ian, that you said that really disturbed me, and it was right at the beginning, which was that the criticism of the scheme had largely been limited to the lower part. And the idea of a tall building of some sort of shape, whether it's exactly what you propose or not, is obviously debatable, was genuinely welcomed. Now, it seems to me that this is an abnegation at all sorts of levels of the method of discussing buildings. well, fine, you know, CABE can talk about the ground level and two or three stories above it. Highway engineers can talk about the ground level. They can cut off a triangular edge of your site if they need to, as they did, although they didn't manage to make the roundabout. When you look at the plans right at the beginning, it was interesting that this, you call it a gateway building, but it's actually not quite the terminuses of the transport system. You know, you've got a sucking great road right alongside it. You've got very close a sucking great railway line. What is made discussable in our very peculiar way of having discourse about buildings and urbanism in this country, be it through institutions like the Royal Academy or LSE, or through statutory bodies like planning controls, CABE, whatever, is that it can deal with the ground level and a bit above it, and can deal with things that are horizontal. But actually dealing with height becomes something that turns into a measure of subjectivity. Now, this seems to me to be to have all sorts of strange effects. That when you talked about height, and in a sense you showed some sort of insight into what we might call a creative process about the design of it, you showed two objects, one of which was 50 years old and another of which was perhaps 80 years old. There's nothing wrong with it, there's no reason why it couldn't be older, there's no reason why it couldn't be newer. But where are we going to go? Where are we going to turn to make the aesthetics of height discussable? When you talked about the surface and the way the building makes a form, again, you were dependent on really quite subjective categories. You were dependent on, you used terms like the movement of the eye, dynamic. Now, this is a general point rather than a specific criticism of what you're doing. It seems to me that what we lack is any way of talking about tall buildings, talking about the height of buildings, that even begins to link with the issues such as the physical and the perhaps more prosaic issues that need to be dealt with at ground level. So we can tear the podium to pieces, but we don't say anything about the height? I mean, this seems to me to be extraordinary. And I think this is perhaps one of the things that we might start to be able to move towards, is how can a level of discourse, a system of ideas, start to be developed that allows one to talk about tall buildings in a way that is informed by what happens at the ground level, and perhaps helps us to transcend some of the normative categories that we use for assessing what happens at the ground level.
It's an interesting problem, but odd point to have a discussion about. But why would you? What I don't understand is why would you sit in a room and have a discussion about aesthetics? Personally, I'd feel that I have my own view on what aesthetics are, and if you don't like those, then fine, I don't care, really, whether you like them or not, personally. And I have quite a strong view in terms of having a debate about what is beautiful. I don't care where my references come from. I'm just, you know, an architect operating, using what references I have. I don't necessarily want to get in a great debate about it. If somebody doesn't like it, fine. If someone who doesn't like it, who's going to prevent planning, fine. I don't understand what the issue is in terms of why we need to have a grand debate about it.
The issue is, why are there two systems of judgment, one dealing with the low level and the other dealing with the high level? When we're dealing with the same building, we're dealing with the same basic creative force behind it. It seems to me to be a bizarre situation that part of the building, part of the scheme, can be discussed in one way according to a particular set of criteria that can be that raises the concerns of statutory bodies, and the rest of it doesn't. It seems to me to be bizarre. It's not per se a criticism of what you designed.
But it's interesting that you look at tall buildings, and there isn't a history necessarily of there's virtually no tall residential buildings other than the Barbican in London. And what to me is that we sort of are living at a moment in time, maybe for the next 50 years or so, whereby we are anxious about height. Not for any reason. There's no reason why we're anxious about seeing a building on our skyline. We go to New York, we love it. The fact that that's a 20th century, it's a new world city, they just built it. Every single, apart from one or two exceptions, virtually every building in New York is appalling as a piece of architecture, as a building, but it works because it's actually about the context of other buildings around it, which again, you look at the city, and that's starting to get a variety of different buildings in that cluster there. But to me, there's an opportunity of just trying to let demand drive things and actually just try and control the quality of what it is that is proposed. I admit, the actual debate and discussion about what is good quality in terms of a tall building is something that hasn't been had. There isn't a debate or a discussion. It's usually just about height, and it's usually about, we'll make it a bit lower and we'll accept it for no other reason than it's a compromise. And there has never been a debate about height. Mm. And, you know, as you say, CABE can only tackle the issues that are very much about the place at ground level, the street, the context that we understand and we've lived with for thousands of years. But it's... I don't know whether it's something that you can actually end up trying to create some sort of set of guidelines for, because to me that all that ends up producing is a formula. And
I think, if I may, the point that we might do is, by allowing us to develop some serious ways of discussing and assessing height, we might be able to re-examine the conventions which are used for looking at the lower level as well and improving them.
I appreciate the mixed use that this project tries to achieve, and the shape of the tower certainly could be beautiful. But talking about beauty and how you said we can recognize it when we see it, we have to recognize that your eyes, or you have to recognize that your eye, has been educated, and certainly our ability as architects to create objects without any social meaning. I am not even talking about the global versus the local meaning, just the social meaning in general. So I would like to know, talking about movement, because you've mentioned the word movement when talking about the form and shape of the tower, what is more important or should be more important when approaching a project? The shape and the movement of the tower, or the movement through the building? What is the priority? Because the movement of those bodies that will hopefully move through this public space, you haven't talked about that. Thank you.
I think it's entirely to do with what the use is of the building, to me. Whether you actually... what is the driver for it? I don't think there's a great social issue in terms of the actual apartments themselves. You know, they are just homes for people. I've already explained that we've spent a lot of time evolving a very open public realm at ground floor level for people to move through and use, and for it to integrate itself into its context in that sense, as a neighborhood, as a place. Clearly, we've also actually introduced vertical movement to the top of the building, but there's no other movement that you can, there's no other movement that I can imagine within the building. So in terms of the ground floor levels, it's more to do with about the place and people and how it is actively used. In terms of the upper levels, it's to do with the form of the building.
Hello, yeah. I was a bit troubled by your remark that the residents will have a small, discreet way of getting to their flats. I mean, there'll be a lot of action on the ground floor for the hotel side, but you said that there'll be a kind of secret little place for the people who have these flats to get there. And that sort of worried me. I mean, it kind of suggests that they're shoved to the back. And I wondered how many lifts are going to be in this building, how long it will take them to get to their flats, traveling up through this distance. And roughly speaking, what sort of economic level are we talking about? I mean, are these going to be really expensive flats or middle? Who is going to live in these places?
They're very expensive flats.
And how long will it take people to get to them from the ground?
It's very quick. It's very quick. Apparently, it's as quick. I live at number 1 Deansgate, and I live on the equivalent of the 15th floor. It's as quick to get to the 69th floor in this building as it is for me to get up currently. They're very fast lifts. It's a very expensive building, but there's lots of poor quality, buildings and residential in Southwark. And I think we're trying to, in many cities, when you introduce this, and actually there are only 89 apartments in the building, that we're actually trying to redress the balance. And in many ways, it's been about trying to create places. Instead of people, once they've made some money, they go off to the leafy suburbs, actually trying to create places for them to stay in our cities and quite often come back into our cities so they don't just become ghettos for those that can't get out. And I've no qualms about the fact that these are expensive apartments. I'd like to try and get all those people that have some money back into the city, particularly in a borough like Southwark or in a city like Manchester, because there isn't a history of that. It's always been the leafy suburbs. Well, obviously, when I say go up quickly, what I'm trying to do is not create a massive, great big entrance for you. It will have a commensurate scale reception space for apartments that start at £3 million. But other than that, it's about actually having activity at ground floor level, not about showing off the fact that you've got some nice Eames chairs in the reception space.
Thanks for your presentation on your slender pregnant woman. Please could you unpack a bit further or put some meat on the sort of the rhetoric of how tall buildings with a 6-star hotel will help, as you said yourself, the impoverished people of Southwark and, say, contrast to Coin Street?
What about Coin Street, sorry?
You can choose to ignore that.
Coin Street's a nice place, isn't it? I mean, I'm talking about Elephant and Castle and places in Peckham and other places like that. And it's about, to me, it's very much about perception change. And you might say, okay, well, that building doesn't actually physically contribute anything other than it creates a public space and it has this whole series of activities. What it does do is say to investors out there that actually Southwark is a place to come and put your money and to create your jobs and to invest. And that will have a particularly knock-on effect in somewhere like Elephant and Castle, where the values won't sustain the new developments that we're talking about.
Could you just explain how the knock-on effects happen?
It's a perception change. All I can say is that if somebody goes to a place and invests money into it, then others who are looking to invest money will say, they've invested in Southwark. That must be the place to go. And it's as simple as that. There's no sophistication to it. I wish there was. But if you look at how cities actually regenerate themselves, it's purely about changing the way they are perceived to the outside world in many ways at a political level. Obviously, as architects, we can then create an infrastructure that helps support those political ambitions in terms of whether it's office buildings or whether it's residential or hotels for people to come and invest into that city or borough. Now, from my experience, and again, there's no magic to it, but if you've got someone saying, I wouldn't spend a penny in there going to Lambeth, then nobody will. But if actually you've got a world-class company coming and wanting to invest jobs and training, which will a lot of it will be local, why can't that be seen as something that is a positive contribution and actually help in terms of the ripple effect, in terms of values? Those adjacent properties will be worth twice as much once that building's built, no matter how much people sort of say, well, you're spoiling my view or whatever. The values will come out of that investment. So that will happen incrementally through the borough. And if Southwark can create some new development in the heart of the Elephant and Castle, and wherever these developers are from, whether they're Americans or Australians or wherever they come and commit to a place, then that will start the process of change, which could take 20, 30 years.
I think it's called capitalism. It's the term. I mean, obviously, for a good period of time now, Southwark hasn't been building in its own right. It doesn't have any money to build in its own right. And it's been trying to attract inward investment, which has been happening in other parts of London. But developers are wary of investing there for reasons of they consider an unstable political background, but also because there's no real infrastructure there. So Southwark are actually encouraging this type of development, and there are a number of leading architects who are being drawn in to build buildings there, which are in many ways exclusive, with the notion that it will have a knock-on effect. But maybe it's late capitalism. But, what hasn't?
Sorry, the Barbican. It's not really a particularly deprived area, the Barbican, is it? It's not. I mean, I've lived in the Barbican, and it's a beautiful place, but it's a very finite 2,000-unit development. There's no, you know, it's a city of London around it. It's an isolated enclave that's set off to be a social housing scheme that actually they couldn't afford to give them away to social housing tenants, so they were sold quite often. And the values in there are astronomical now. It doesn't need to do. Why does it? It's not in the middle of Southwark, is it? It's not in the Elephant and Castle. The Barbican's surrounded by the City of London. Oh, and Shoreditch hasn't come on, has it? Hoxton. Would you live in Elephant and Castle rather than Shoreditch? I mean, let's get it real. The values in Shoreditch and Hoxton and the art galleries and the trendy bars that are all in there, they don't exist in Elephant and Castle, do they, or Peckham? All right, I'm sorry, I don't know Peckham, obviously. I know Southwark. I know Barbican.
Yes, just to add to the last question in terms of regeneration and urban design in the cities, the Manchester project seems quite interesting, and in your own terms that you thought that the Manchester people liked the idea and were very keen on it. But I feel that the Southwark project sort of sticks out. It's sort of, to use the word, a carbuncle on the local landscape. Considering how poor Southwark is as a borough in terms of the South Bank, do you not think that it's a bit of almost an enigma? It sort of sticks out. It looks spectacular in terms of site and design, but I think it doesn't blend into, even in terms of Elephant and Castle, it doesn't blend with anything that's around it. It sticks out. It looks rather exciting, but do you not think that it should... Well, there should have been more consultation in terms of how
there has been. Yeah, I don't really want to go. I mean, there have obviously been consultation, and you're obviously entitled to your own view. But to me, there isn't much to relate to in Elephant and Castle. I mean, that's just a 60s development that's going to be totally demolished and rebuilt because it's a failed development. So how can one actually start with change in response to that context? I mean, okay, there aren't that many buildings, but as I say, in 50 years' time, it'll be totally different. Look at the building. I showed you some of that, the Allsop scheme. Okay, it's a small-scale office building down Blackfriars Road, but it's nothing to do with anything else that's around there. It's about starting again, virtually, and that's the way I feel. And whatever clusters we look at in our cities, they all started with one building.
First of all, I think it's very beautiful and interesting of this object, like you say. But in the future, I think it will become a symbol of London because it's high and very tall. Do you think this phone need to have any connection with London or with this site? Or you think in the future we will have a lot of high buildings, so it just will become a most beautiful and one of them? Yes, my question.
Sorry, I just missed the last bit there.
It was about connectivity to the city. Can it just be beautiful, or should it have a reference to London itself? Is that right?
Because I think this building will become a symbol in the future. So maybe this unique and beautiful need to have some connection with London or with this site. It's the first question. Or you think in the future we will have a lot of high buildings. So this building just will become the most beautiful one and one of them. So it's not very important to be a symbol of London.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to define what becomes a symbol for a place or a city. I certainly don't ever set out to try and create any sort of icon wherever we are working. If they are adopted by the people of the city or nicknamed or whatever, I'm quite happy with that. I don't mind however it's used. And in other cities, we've had buildings used to promote the city, like Urbis has been used on BA posters and all sorts of things. So it's not something that, as an architect, that we set out as an ambition. It's something that I think either follows or it doesn't follow. It's not something that we set out to achieve.
It's interesting, if I just add to that, that what's now called 30 St Mary Axe, and you probably know better as the Gherkin, which people were very anxious about originally, has become that sort of iconic building in the Eastern Cluster. Its profile appears on images of what central London is all about. And indeed, there was someone from English Heritage not so long ago who suggested that views of that building should be preserved and that no other tall building should be built around it. Now, those of you who came to Lee Polizzano's lecture on tall buildings will have been entertained by Peter Rees as Chief Planning Officer for the city. His recent utterance was that, in fact, he wanted many more towers in the Eastern Cluster and with very varied forms, and he likened his concept for the Eastern Cluster as a fruit basket.
Well, I think it takes great courage to stand up and defend something that is very personal and very visionary, and that's obviously to be commended. But you are creating an icon, and I think that the thing I would like to know, and I'm sure quite a few of us in here would like to know, is all buildings of this type actually have a nickname. What nickname would you give your building?
The pregnant lady was already been used by somebody. I don't. We haven't. It has to be somebody else that gives it a name. I don't know where to start. Well, we haven't really got a tall building.
Sorry? Yet.
We haven't really got a tall building in London. There isn't a tall, I mean, not in real terms. You look at.
Well, of the tall buildings we have, do any of you consider that they have any worth contributing to?
I think, I personally really love tall buildings, and I think we live in a.
But I think it's
I'm sure Lee Positano would disagree with that. But
well, it may well be because there are so many forces against creating something which is a clear statement. Well, English Heritage, CAVE, GLA, the Barra planning officers.
Development, and I'd be very interested to see how it does develop, particularly on the ground. As you say, I think there's quite a lot that you'd like to explore there. From what I
there's a lot, yes. Yeah, there's a lot of work to do. Yeah.
I might just wrap things up this evening, but I would like to say a special thanks to the London School of Economics and Professor Taverner, who've been, I think, for the Royal Academy. Just speaking of the Royal Academy's behalf, it has been a very interesting series for us, and it gives us an ability to explore some issues outside of the academy, hopefully drawing on a different audience. I've seen a lot of places who have been to a number of the lectures, and I think it has been quite interesting, and I hope you have enjoyed the series and you have come together just this evening, etc. So please join me in thanking Ian Simpson one more time. Thank you.